iHeartRadio presents Inside the Studio. I'm your host, Joe Levy. Now, this episode was recorded in London, where I spent some of my time doing exactly what Americans in London usually do: eating fish and chips, drinking beer, and walking by Buckingham Palace while silently playing the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen inside my head. But I also got to spend some time pretty far off the tourist track, talking with Niall Horan about his new album, Heartbreak Weather, and his upcoming tour with Lewis Capaldi. I met up with Niall at his rehearsal space, where I heard him and his band run through some pinpoint harmonies for the excellent new song Everywhere, which is about being haunted by the memory of an ex. You know, seeing that face everywhere you go. Except Everywhere doesn't sound haunted. It's up-tempo and full of guitars that are headed straight towards the rafters. Niall has said Heartbreak Weather has some sad songs dressed up as happy songs, and Everywhere sounds like one of those. As Niall told me when we sat down to talk, Heartbreak Weather is sort of a concept album. It charts the course of a relationship, so it starts with three totally over-the-top love songs. I mean, one of them imagines looking back on a marriage from age 65, and it ends with two songs about holding on to feelings for someone who's no longer there. In between comes some songs about hookups, like Small Talk and Nice to Meet You, and some about breakups, like Put a Little Love on Me. Niall wanted to make a breakup album, but a different kind of breakup album. One that had shifting points of views where most breakup albums can be selfish.
They're always kind of like, I'm sitting at home, you've made me so sad, and there is songs on the album which are like that. Now, I have a song called Arms of a Stranger on there that is literally like, you left me with nothing, now I'm lying in the arms of a stranger. And then there's also songs that I've written from different sides of it where it's about them. It might sound like it's about me, but I've written it about them.
Heartbreak Weather is Niall's second album. His first, Flicker, came out in 2017. But at 26, he's already been a pop star for a full decade. That's how long it's been since he tried out for X Factor UK, didn't make the cut as a solo artist, but got put in a group with four other guys. That group, of course, was One Direction. And for 6 years and five albums, One Direction was pop music's juggernaut. Their first four albums debuted at number one on the Billboard 200. No other group had done that before. And they put 14 songs in the top 10 of the Hot 100 chart, four of which went to number one. When the group went on hiatus and the 1D guys started putting out solo albums, Zayn Malik in 2016, Harry Styles and Niall in 2017, those went to number one too. You can pick your completely inappropriate comparison point, but it's hard to think of a group that spawned this kind of solo success outside of the Beatles or NWA, neither of whom ever sang a chart-topping mashup of Blondie's One Way or Another and the Undertones' Teenage Kicks. As that should have made clear, One Direction were closer to a power pop group than a pure pop product, except 1D was pegged as a boy band by a world that is not long on respect for super catchy music made by cute boys who rose to fame through television. Shout out to the Monkees, and especially is not long on respect when you can barely hear that music over the screams of stadiums full of young women. But whether you liked them or not, and I did, One Direction were something special. Think of them as the Pixar of pop music, both assembled by teams of professional fun makers working together to invent new tricks for an established medium, both relying on state-of-the-art techniques charged up by a combination of super smarts and super heightened emotions, happy and sad, both packed with bright colors and humor that dazzles kids, but also full of bits aimed at the parents. I mean, that's how I always heard the classic rock riffs embedded in 1D songs, The Who's Baba O'Reilly in Best Song Ever, or The Clash's Should I Stay or Should I Go in While We're Young, or Def Leppard's Pour Some Sugar on Me in Midnight Memories, Journey's Faithfully in Steal My Girl, Queen's We Will Rock You in Rock Me. Or at least that's how I heard them before Harry Styles and Niall released their first albums, both of which were heavily indebted to the classic rock California singer-songwriter sound of the 1970s, albeit in very different ways. Harry came off more like a Nilsson, weirdo, studio obsessive, and Niall more like James Taylor, heartbroken, trying to get over it, although both of them sounded like they'd crashed a Fleetwood Mac recording session. Niall has said he's known how he wanted that first album to sound since he was a kid playing Bob Dylan and Beatles covers in Irish pubs for older patrons. But for the new Heartbreak Weather, he was a little more free with the process and the sound, a little less worried about it sounding like something that came before, so maybe it ended up sounding a little more like him. A song like No Judgment started out with him playing around with a riff that reminded him of an old John Mayer song, Neon, but it became something different once he put a 2020 groove under it. Niall talked with me about starting writing while he was recovering from sinus surgery and also getting over a breakup, about recording at a studio in the Bahamas that has a champagne bottle vending machine, and about what it's like to stand in front of 15,000 people and sing about your feelings. Here's what else he had to say. Niall, welcome to Inside the Studio.
Very, very welcome to London, you are. And thanks for having me on your podcast.
So let's start with the album title. What is Heartbreak Weather? Where did the phrase come from? What does it mean? And how does the weather change?
It's been raining here for about 2 weeks, so it doesn't change that often. Heartbreak Weather kind of came from... I wanted to write like a breakup album, but not very selfishly. When you write breakup albums, they all tend to be very selfish sounding, like very, you know, all about you and how sad you are instead of thinking about other people. So when I was writing down ideas for it, I was just kind of thinking, how do I write all the different feelings? Because it's not always like sad, or there's happy days as well when you go through a breakup, and there's feelings that you shouldn't feel, you know, and you do it. And Heartbreak Weather was just something I wrote down. And the minute I wrote down, I was like, this has now become a concept, a concept album. Because now I can write different feelings and relate them to different weather patterns. So I was like, you know, if it's a sunny song, it's going to be a little bit more egotistical. And if it's a ballad, it's going to be a little bit stormy and rainy. And that kind of helped me stick with the concept. So from minute one, the album was always going to be called Heartbreak Weather.
And when you say breakup albums can be selfish, do you mean... only from one point of view, you're not thinking about the other person?
In a way, yeah. They're always kind of like, I'm sitting at home, you've made me so sad. And there is songs on the album which are like that. Now, I have a song called Arms of a Stranger on there that is literally like, you left me with nothing, now I'm lying in the arms of a stranger. And then there's also songs that I've written from different sides of it where, you know, it's about them. It might sound like it's about me, but I've written it about them, you know. Or
so even though you're speaking from the first person, you might actually be coming from the other point of view.
Yeah, so sometimes it might sound like I'm saying something, but I've actually just, in terms of the Heartbreak Weather concept, I was writing from a different point of view. Or there's just different songs for different angles, and I'll probably have to explain it at some point. But just once you know that every song is not about me and how selfish I am, then it'll help.
You talked about the different moods. Two of the first songs we heard, Nice to Meet You, mm-hmm. Put a Little Love on Me. Mm-hmm. Those are very different moods. One's very interior and one's really about going out on the town.
Yeah, literally. That's kind of the Heartbreak Weather thing again. You know, the egotistical one in Nice to Meet You comes out and makes a load of noise and talks about going around London on a tear, and then Put a Little Love on Me is a piano ballad written with the rain bashing against the window and, you know, in the hills of Hollywood. It's kind of like, you know, they're two contrasting things, and that's kind of the theme across the album.
And of course, Heartbreak Weather itself, the title track, you're really singing about being on the other side of the heartbreak weather, right? You know, the sun's come up. It's a love song, right?
Yeah. No, in terms of the track listing of the album, I wanted to tell the story from the start of the relationship, through the relationship, the feelings you might have within the relationship, and then out the back and how you feel. And you'll see that if you listen to the album throughout. Heartbreak Weather is kind of like what it was. It was all sleepwalk living, and it's been hardship. It's been heartbreak weather. It's been sleepwalk living up until this point, and now I met you. That's how the album kicks off. Black and White was one for me where I was kind of like trying to go nostalgic and be thinking like when I was 15 and got my first girlfriend, I was like, that's it, marrying you. You know, and that's why I was trying. I had the title Black and White and I was thinking, how do I make it different? And that's what happens when you first get with someone and you're in that honeymoon period.
It's black and white. It's crystal clear. The whole world is black and white to you. Yeah. It's this or that. And the this in that song is I'm completely in love. You're imagining at one point when you're 65 years old and the two of you are together.
Yeah, I just kind of like was thinking how I had the title and I was just running with it. And I was thinking, how do you change this? And I was kind of thinking like, when you were a kid and the first person you meet, you're like, I'm going to marry you. And then it was kind of like, you know, thinking of a wedding scenario and the black being the suit and the white being the dress.
Oh, so the top of the wedding cake. The bride and groom in black and white.
I see us and, you know, I see us in black and white, crystal clear on a starlit night. And it's kind of like very nostalgic thinking. And, you know, that honeymoon period when you first get with someone and it's like, this is it.
You hear the first few songs you've released, particularly Put a Little Love on Me. Mm. You think about the album title, Heartbreak Weather. Mm. People may get the impression that this is a sad breakup album, yeah. But those first three songs, they're about falling in love. And the third one, we talked about the first two, the third one, Dear Patience, the singer or you are telling yourself, slow down. Yeah. Let's try not to get to the altar before we've gotten to the bedroom almost.
Yeah, because these are all the things that go on in your head. Like when you start a relationship, you're like, I really like you. This is probably going to work, but if I slow down a bit and be a bit more patient, I'll probably make the best of it. So that's where Dear Patience came from. And it's kind of like literally writing a letter to patience, the feeling of patience, and like telling yourself, all right, this time, don't F it up. and just be patient with it because it could be really good if you let it.
How did the process, the songwriting recording process, change between the first record, Flicker, and the second record?
This one was a bit more, I found a bit more off the cuff, like in terms of the recording. Like the last album I was in with full band in the room, playing everything completely live and then doing overdubs and stuff. But this album I found like I was just kind of, as you said, I'd go and write songs so they could happen anywhere. You know, I was just writing songs. Some of them were written at home. Some of them were written in the studio. And then we'd kind of play instruments as we were going. A lot of this album was kind of done at home, really, to be honest, written. Because my idea was that I would just write songs and then dress them up however I feel production-wise later on. Just write the song first. Because before, I kind of pigeonholed myself a touch. I was noodling away, playing like finger-picky type stuff, which straight away sends you down the alley of, okay, now we're writing a folk song. And that's what I kind of did to myself on the first album. I mean, in hindsight, the album did really well, so I can't complain. But, you know, I know what I need to do next time. And this time I just wanted to just go in, write the song, and then whatever happens afterwards, we'll make a decision on that later.
The first album isn't all finger-picking folk songs. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's got some big pop songs on it. But this one I heard, unafraid of pop, unafraid of R&B, unafraid of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. I listened to this one and I thought, oh yeah, he's got his swagger back.
Yeah, no, with the success of Slow Hands, I thought, well, if an 80s, what I think is like an 80s blues jam meets pop music can do well on the charts of R&B and hip hop, well, you know, and it did well, like it stood out, you know? I was thinking, well, maybe I can just take a few more chances. And that's why I was thinking, right, just let's just go and write the song. And the dressing up can be done afterwards. But the success of Slow Hands made me walk into the room this time and think about things differently.
Let's talk about how this record happened. You finished the Flicker tour. 81 shows around the world.
Oof.
That was September 2018, you're done. What happened then?
I went back to... Where did I go? I went straight back to London for a few weeks and then I went back to LA. No, I went back to London for like 10 days, then went back to LA and I had to have sinus surgery.
Sinus surgery?
Yeah, it was like there was like some sort of drip from my... Like I would get in sinus infections all the time and it would like drip onto my vocal cords and kind of burn them. So when I would lay down at night, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I would be barely able to talk because like all the drip would like dry out my throat. over the course of the night. So that's not great for a singer. So I've been talking about getting it done for a while, but then the schedule got in the way. So I had that done. And then I was in kind of, the doctor told me to kind of stay at home for like 10 days, 2 weeks. So that's what I did. And I was just kind of bored. And then I wasn't planning on writing for a while. I was going to take a bit of time, obviously. I lasted like 3 weeks off the back of the tour. Sat down at the piano one day and started writing the verse and the chorus for Put a Little Love on Me. And then I was just gone.
So the first thing you wrote for this album was Put a Little Love on
Me. Yeah, I had those chords. Just I sat down and played those chords and just kind of went... And then from there, that's where the album started. And once you start, it's the best bug you've ever had. It's like you just keep going and you can't stop. Next week I wrote No Judgment and just off.
But you were just a few weeks off tour and recovering from sinus surgery.
I shouldn't have been doing anything.
Well, I mean, you didn't exactly take a vacation, did you?
No, I didn't. To be honest, I'm not very like... Actually, I went to a friend's wedding first week of October in Spain. That's why I went back to the UK after my tour. Then we met up in London and then we went to a wedding in Spain and took about a week off basically and then went back to the States and just started writing.
What do you do to recharge then?
I'm not like a sit on the beach type holiday person. Also, a lot of my friends have like 9-to-5 jobs, so it's not like I can be just like, come on guys, do you want to just come for 2 weeks with me somewhere? And they're like, no, because we've got a job. So I couldn't do that. So I just kind of play a lot of golf. It's, you know, like, yeah, I don't know. I just go back to Ireland for a bit. Yeah, just kind of general chilling stuff. I'm not like a on the beach type person.
But you did record some of this record on the beach because you did record at Sanctuary Studios in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
Where I've read a little about this place. The live room overlooks a marina that's full of yachts.
Yeah.
And I believe it has one of three vending machines in the entire world that dispenses split bottles of Moet champagne. This sounds like a place the Stones would have recorded in the 70s. What was it like?
I mean, it was the best 10 days I've ever had. A friend of mine lives in the Bahamas, so I was down there anyway. And all my writing partners came down for 10 days and we just went into the studio. I mean, the studio, it sounds ridiculous. It sounds baller, if you like. I mean, the way they've built the building, you can always see boats in the marina. It's like the windows are like kind of slatted and you can see yachts, like 200-foot yachts pulling in and all sorts. It's a bit obnoxious. But do you know what? Surprisingly, because we're not in LA or we're not in London and people have lives to go back to at the end of the day, it didn't feel like we were... You know, if we're in LA, we go into the studio at 11 and we leave at 6 or 7, and that's just like, it's more of like a job, like a working hours job. Whereas, you know, because people have to bring kids to school or pick kids up from school or go home and make dinners or something like that. Whereas if we set a time to go away and that's all we have to do is write songs, we don't even have to, like, if we don't want to sleep, we don't have to sleep. You know, it's kind of like... So we actually wrote a lot more than I thought we would.
You say your songwriting collaborators who were down there with you, who came down for this trip?
Julian Bonetta, John Ryan, who I always work with very closely. They're like my two of my best friends, and we've known each other for a long time.
And you've been working with them since the One Direction days.
Yeah, they did basically the last three 1D albums, effectively. And we work really close together. And then there was Tobias Gesso Jr., who we wrote, me, myself and Julian wrote Slow Hands with. So we'd worked well together before, and we had written No Judgment before we went to the Bahamas. So that went well. He's the greatest guy in the world. Teddy Geiger and Scott Harris, who are obviously super famous for all their, Shawn Mendes stuff, who's also a good friend of mine. And Explicit, who is a famous Miami writer, wrote the famous hit Work From Home by Fifth Harmony, but also a good friend of mine. So it was kind of like friends go on holiday and write songs at the same time.
And everybody was down there at the same time.
Yeah, and we would split off into groups. So like I would start...
So it was like a writing camp almost. Writing camp being sort of where different songwriting teams come in and write songs, but it was your writing camp, as it
yeah.
were.
Like yeah, my own writing camp. Yeah. And I would like... I have loads of ideas and concepts and stuff like that and stuff that I want to write about. And would have like a verse or a chorus or something already. I prepped well before the trip, and then I would like walk into the room with, say, Teddy and Scott, and say, right, I've got this concept and there's this verse, and then they would kick it off, and then I would go in and start another one with like me and Julian, and then go back to them every like 20 minutes and like...
This is all happening at the same time? Room to room, song to song?
But that's what they were, like, we were talking about. We all went for dinner in LA a few weeks ago, and it was just like, I was so busy in the Bahamas that, like, I think I got sick when I came back because I was just running around the place from room to room. We had a massive studio and I was all over the place.
And you really have no chill. You just went like song to song, not even a day to work on one song or one project.
And then there were some songs we hadn't finished, like Nice to Meet You didn't have a bridge. And so me, Tobias and Julian went into the studio one day and finished off, you know, I sung in something and then we wrote lyrics to it. Or No Judgment didn't have a verse or second verse or something, and we were doing that as well. So we were writing new songs and finishing old ones.
Wait, did you even use the vending machine that spits out the champagne bottles?
Yeah, we actually did. Yeah, they had these like gold coins, you know, like slot coins, and they were, you could like have so many a day or whatever as part of your studio bill. But it was good that the studio had like a hot tub in it.
The studio had a hot tub in it.
It's a joke. It's like insane. I mean, it's to entice the rich and famous down, you know, to use the studio. And
wow, so this was like prep for that SNL skit where you got to be in the hot tub with Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah. Scarlett, weirdly enough, wasn't in at our writing session in the Bahamas, but but yeah, the studio was just a joke. But I just couldn't believe how much work we'd got done. We would go down to the beach at sunset every day just for like 15 minutes just to be like, we need to get out of this room. And we ended up writing Everywhere on the Beach one day. I mean, a few of us, the song Everywhere we wrote on the beach. And I mean, I think the opening verse even has a line that says, you know, it feels like the world's locked us in an island without waves, as the waves are breaking and the tide's going out. The tide's coming in. It was pretty cool. But yeah, it was just such a good time because we were just all that, we were there for one reason and one reason only, was to write tunes and hang out. And yeah, it was good fun. We had a great time.
You mentioned Nice to Meet You. I want to start with one thing I'd heard you say previously, that when you were working on this song with Tobias Gesso Jr., mm-hmm. you said, I'd probably written 50 songs.
Mm.
Now, what does that mean? I always hear people say that, but does that mean you've written, like, you finished 50 songs, you recorded 50 songs, you wrote 50 one-line verses, you know, like, bits of verses down? What?
No, probably written 50 odd, like I'd say, if I was to guess, I'd say 53 or 4 songs for the whole album written. Bear in mind, 60% of that is horrendous. You know what I mean? Like, you have days where it's just like, what are we even doing? And maybe like 50 verses and like 20 verses and choruses, and then 50, like 30 full songs. And like, you know, there's kind of like, it's a bit of dribs and drabs, but you can see, like, if I've got a verse and a chorus, I know that I can pretty much match that on the other side. I use it like a symmetrical, like first verse, pre-chorus, take a break, start the next part. But kind of dribs and drabs, but I would say like a good solid 40 odd songs, full songs.
How does it happen for you? How many of those were ideas that you might have flashed on while you were touring or before you even started the songwriting process for this record?
Things like No Judgment, I already had the riff. I wrote the riff in, I think it was in Chicago or something, on tour, like 6 months previous to writing it. So I was in Chicago in like July or August, and then, yeah, July maybe.
And you say you wrote the riff. Were you playing around on guitar, on piano?
Yeah, what? Just sitting on the bus, just in the middle of the day between meet and greet or something, and just and the show, and just like, just start going. And before you know it, I've just got a really good riff and didn't really know what to do with it, and then tried to match it up to a concept that I thought sounded sexy.
Barefoot and a bottle of wine. You can stay with me tonight. You don't have to change when I'm around you. So go ahead and say what's on your mind, on your mind.
The song was a bit more kind of like John Mayer-ish, kind of like neon, that kind of continuum type era. And then it developed because we put that groove underneath it, kind of turned into a pop song. But subconsciously, you know.
You're on tour in Chicago. It's in between a meet and greet. Mm. You're playing around. You have this riff. So do you get out your phone and record it? How do you capture it?
Yeah, I take it out the phone. And what I was doing last year a lot of the time was we would jam on stage as part of our sound check and just get the front of house guy to record like bits and then like record 10 minutes of it and then email me it straight away. So then I have like an actual recording of us sound checking.
Did anything from those sound checks end up on the record?
One nearly did. Yeah, there was a song I ended up writing with Tobias that nearly did. Yeah, I must try and find that. But yeah, like bits and pieces, not much. It was more like you're just trying to think of ideas to be a catalyst for when you go into the studio, because you know there's a lot of, if I just turn up in the studio on day one and don't know what I'm going to write about, it's going to be a lot harder album to make, you know.
You mentioned you were playing around with the riff for No Judgment and the song was coming together and it was a little more John Mayer-ish. Were there any artists, were there anything that you turned to for inspiration that you were listening to or thinking of when you're making this record? I know when you made Flicker, you talked a little bit about Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles and whether the record sounded like that or not. That really stuck to that record, idea.
Yeah, no, that definitely like helped me as I went on. This one, I was kind of like, it was a bit of everything. Different songs for productions for different songs. So like in my head, Cross Your Mind was kind of like, you know, you use songs as references, you know, like going and absolutely robbed the place blind. But, you know, like Walking on a Dream by Empire of the Sun was kind of like a nice reference for Across Your Mind, because Across Your Mind actually started as a piano ballad. And I actually have a video on my phone of me writing Across Your Mind, and the demo was a piano ballad of singing slow and love the way you hurt me and it doesn't even cross your mind. And then but every time I played it on the piano, I kept like tapping my foot like faster and faster every time I played it, and I was like, no, this needs to be a jam. And it turned into effectively an Empire of the Sun meets Fleetwood Mac driving tune.
Yeah, I mean, when you sing it now, I hear the way it is finished. I can't imagine it as a slow and sad piano ballad, because it's got that, it's got a groove. Mm. I mean, and a groove that could go in a lot of different directions. Yeah. It could be an R&B song. It can be, can be the song it ended up as. But this album has that strong pop bounce to it.
I always try and do like pop with my twist on it. You know, I absolutely love pop music and kind of, but I don't want to sound like everyone else, if you know what I mean. So I try and like do my own little twist on it. And I mean, bringing Fleetwood Mac into a pop song is, you know, something to behold, I suppose. And like I try and do things differently.
And I guess maybe it sounds like you're bringing that into the pop world now, into that machine tooled, computerized pop sound. Mm. But remember, Fleetwood Mac were the biggest pop band in the world in their moment.
But that's the thing. Like, I remember Julian Bonetta saying to me, he got like, I'm always trying to like find different older drum sounds when we put grooves on stuff. And Julian said to me, he goes, you know all those bands that you love, like the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac, do you think that they were looking for old drums? He said they were looking for the drum sounds that were big at their time. They were writing songs around the grooves. And then from then on, I was like, you're so right. I was doing that for a while, where I was like chasing down old 70s tunes and 80s tunes for a drum groove or a sound or a snare sound, because I'm like so particular about stuff like that. But I just remembered, I'm a 21st century pop act. You know what I mean? Like I have to play to it too, you know?
Well, we were just talking about Cross Your Mind starting as a sad piano ballad. So let's talk about the sad piano ballad. Put a Little Love on Me.
Mm-hmm.
Which, just the title, sounds a bit like a Rod Stewart come on from the 70s or something. But that's not what it is. So tell me about how this song came about.
Just at that sinus surgery time, just sat at the piano and just went bum, 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 bum. To me, it sounded quite like Elton-y, the way I played it. Like the dancey bum, 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 bum. And in my head I was thinking, like, what would Elton do now? So I even go to minor chords and like at the end of the chorus and stuff like that. And literally in my head the whole time I was thinking, what would Elton do now? So I just started singing along and I had a concept for it that was like one of the first things that I wanted to write, because I'd just gone through a breakup and there were certain things that I needed to say straight away. And the first verse just flew out of my mouth and the pre. And then I went in, when I came back, I was like, I'm going to leave this because I know someone that can help me with this. And then with Jamie Scott, who I'd written This Town and Too Much to Ask with, and he'd written Story of My Life at One Direction and stuff like that. And he's a very good friend of mine. And we were planning on going into the studio anyway. So I was like, Jamie will be really good at this. And he's an unbelievable piano player. And we went in and he loved it. And we just kept playing and playing and got to the end. And he played the first pass of the piano. And I went in and recorded a vocal. Like, did two takes of the vocal or something like that. I just loved the vocal and loved like the rawness of the song, and didn't kind of, was thinking, I don't really want to overproduce this. But then the longer it went on, I was like, no, I want to produce it now. And we gave it, a couple of shots in with different producers and had it produced a few times. And I just kept coming back to the first pass of the piano and the first vocal. So what we hear now is literally just the day one demo of when we finished the song, which is rare. But I mean, those productions could be amazing, and they were, but you just have a feeling deep down.
So knowing that this is the first thing that you recorded or first thing you wrote, and knowing that you were just a few weeks off tour, now I think I understand a bit the little bit of the Easter egg, the lyric on this song that connects to a lyric from a song on Flickr.
Okay.
Too Much to Ask, right? In that song, your shadow is dancing on its own for the first time. In this one, shadows come up again, but now the lights are up and there are no shadows dancing.
Yeah, no, I just thought it'd be nice to reflect it back to another song that myself and Jamie had written. And we were talking, he was going, shadows, like he was doing that. And I was like, oh, stop there for a sec. We can actually push this back to, put this back on Too Much to Ask and literally do what you said. You know, in the previous song, the shadows were, you know, dancing without you for the first time. And in this song now, there's no shadows dancing because there's no one to dance with.
Right.
So yeah, I just thought it was a cool little nod to the, and the fans picked up on it straight away. Like they were like, oh.
This song has a lyric that's just amazingly plain spoken.
Mm-hmm.
Watch the sun coming up. Don't it feel fucked up? We're not in love.
Mm-hmm.
And then Put a Little Love on Me has a song that is also super plain spoken. Is it wrong? I still wonder where you are. Is it wrong? I still don't know my heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then in Bend the Rules on this album, there's a moment where you're talking about, you know, when somebody makes you laugh, but you won't say what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt that. That's
a real
moment.
Yeah, yeah.
We have those moments like where you're watching someone you love kind of spark to something else and you're wondering, what the hell is that about?
What is that about? Yeah, but you don't want to be needy and say it out loud. Or,
well,
you know?
Speak for yourself. But, but these kind of brutally honest lyrics are really shaping up to be a specialty of yours.
Yeah, I hope they're connecting with people. Cause I don't know, like I just, those ballads, like they all come from that same sit down at the piano and just say. Sometimes like when I'm writing a ballad, I'll actually speak instead of sing. And like nearly write an out loud poem to music and do what you've just done there. Just like, is it wrong that I still don't know my heart? And then try and sing a melody around that or whatever. Yeah, just like, I don't know. Hopefully get the credit for the nice lyrics at some point down the line. Hopefully, we'll see what happens.
Well, I mean, you know, look, all of us have used music when we're sad. We've used it as a form of therapy. Songwriting sounds like it's a form of therapy for you. You sit down and you just talk the lyrics out. It seems like you should be paying the piano a therapist fee.
Maybe, yeah. Have a little like collection box at the top of the piano and pay the fee every time I sit down.
When those lyrics are that brutally plain spoken and honest,
mm-hmm.
Do you ever worry about being that vulnerable?
No, I don't. At all, actually. I probably, when I was younger, used to be like, I wouldn't say stuff in interviews or I wouldn't put a lyric in a song because I didn't want people to be talking about it. But what I've realized is when you're vulnerable, people want to know who it's about for about 2 seconds. And the tabloids make a story out of it and the online websites make a story out of it for 10 minutes. And those stories only ever last a day. And then after that, people actually connect with the lyrics. Like, you've no idea what the songs are about, but you've made them a connection yourself, as you said. And that's what I love about what we do, because the flash in the pan story is over. And then I go on tour and I look at the crowd and I'll see 3 or 4 girls in the first 10 rows crying their eyes out. And that's the best part, because they don't know who the song's about. They've just connected it to something in their life. And I think the older I've got, the more I've realized the power of actually writing lyrics. And I think that's why I like to write ballads more, because you get that feeling out with people. Because when the lyrics, like, I'm very good at like dressing a sad song up as a happy song. So, but if you're dancing at a concert, you don't necessarily listen to the lyrics. You're just singing out and you're screaming at the top of your lungs. But if you're listening to a ballad, you're a bit more like attentive and like listening and breaking the lyrics down in your head. And that's what makes you emotional, I suppose.
But you know who these songs are about. You know what these songs are about. And you're going to go out and sing them every night. And that never... That's not a trigger for you? That never makes you feel vulnerable in that way?
I mean, sometimes, you know, like, I like to, when I write a song, once I've like released it, I like to think of it as not, kind of not mine anymore.
If belongs, you know what I mean, to the audience now.
Now it's up to them to decide what they do with it.
And those girls in the front row who are bawling their eyes out.
That's what's for them.
And it becomes their story as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because if they can connect to like Too Much to Ask or The Shadows Dancing line or the line you said in Bend the Rules, like if they can do that, then that's what it's about. Because I've already, my therapy side of it came when I was shouting the lyrics at the piano. You know what I mean? That's where that, I got my bit out of it. And obviously, if there is times when you're thinking back, like there's been times where, like on the first tour, where I like had a wobbly bottom lip, you know, because I was singing like Flicker or something and thinking, oh Jesus, you know, when you have a day where you're like, oh, I miss her. You know what I mean? And then there's nothing more of a catalyst and standing in front of 15,000 people singing about your feelings. But you do, and it happens every now and then. But yeah, I mean, after a while, it's like anything. Time is the healer, I suppose. And then by the time I get out on tour, I've kind of half healed.
But it also sounds the way in which the audience can make this their own stories and put their own feelings into it makes it more of a shared experience than just your experience.
Yeah, I mean, well, like I have fans. So, I mean, I'm not always like selfishly writing for myself. You know, you write lyrics, you write, like that's why I like the storyteller. The storytellers always have done well over the years in terms of the lyricists. Because the storyteller, that's why country music is so big. Because it's just storytelling. It's relatable storytelling that everyone can connect with. And all over the years, the greatest artists of all time have always been storytellers. Bruce Springsteen, he always says, I've made a full career, he said it in a show on Broadway, I've made a full career out of writing about something I've never done, which is work in a factory or have a normal 9-to-5 job. But he said,
Because all he's ever been is a musician, right?
Yeah.
He didn't really ever have the day job.
No. But he wrote about factories and car factories and blah, 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 blah.
His first band was called Steel Mill.
Exactly.
He didn't work in one.
Never worked in one. And self-admittedly, but he connected with the people. Elton John, Simon and Garfunkel, Bob, the greatest of all time, Bob Dylan. Like, they're the storytellers and they've always done well. Taylor Swift, massive, tells stories in the most relatable, nostalgic way. Ed Sheeran, the same. When I was 6 years old, I broke my leg, Castle on the Hill, you know, like that. People just relate to that stuff. So I find that, yeah, that's why I do it, I think.
Everywhere on the new album, really striking song. It's about a feeling of seeing someone you're trying to forget everywhere you go. I see your face in people I don't know. That's another lyric. I heard that. I felt that. I was, because I've had that experience. The music has some sense of desperation in it, but it's also really triumphant, right? And yeah. You were mentioning you're good at writing turning a sad song into a happy song.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And this kind of feels like one.
Yeah, this is it, because it's Four on the Floor. It gives you that I'm going to roll my windows down or stand in a stadium type feel. It's got,
and
like,
the guitars are soaring, almost like U2 style.
Yeah, that's the idea. Stick a load of reverb on the guitars and just lay into it and distort them and kind of leave it all out there. And that's why I do. You'll find that in a lot of my songs, the production in the verse is very simple. So like in Everywhere, it's just going boom, ding, 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 ding. And then when the chorus hits, it's like, because you like to get into desperation in the verse and then have a triumphant chorus. And I try to do that quite a lot. Everywhere, yeah, as you say, it's like literally, I felt like when I'd broken up from my last relationship, I honestly felt like I was seeing the person everywhere. For different reasons, but I was also literally seeing, I remember when Teddy said that, when we were writing Everywhere, and Teddy said, I see your face in people I don't know. I was like, that is genius, because that sums up this song. There's always a line that wraps the song up. And Yeah, you just cut. You feel like you just couldn't get away from it. Like, because when you break up with someone, you're either one of two things: you want them back, or you're trying to run from them. But you can't. When you see them everywhere you go, you can't help it.
I don't think I'd ever really thought of Instagram as the everywhere you might see someone.
Well,
but you've been there.
Yeah, exactly. It has to happen. This is 2020 now.
But I'm just used to, oh, that's somebody who has the same haircut or the same color
still,
hair.
Still get it? That, but
again, I hadn't thought of it that way. I'm just thinking from my perspective, seeing somebody, you know, on the block who literally reminds you of that person who you know, you get that sudden, it's almost like a chemical reaction. Like you think you're actually seeing that person.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But you're not.
Yeah, honestly, it's and I think that's just part of it, isn't it? Like, you can't help it. You're not seeing them at all. It's like, I don't know. It's like fucking believing in the paranormal or something like that. Like, it's just like they're not there, but you know what I mean? You just kind of, you keep seeing them everywhere you go. It's nuts.
We were talking about this a little bit. People will want to know who these songs are about, mm-hmm. but they were asking the same questions about songs on Flickr.
Mm-hmm.
Does that bother you? Does it matter?
No. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter at all, because they'll connect, as I said earlier, they'll connect with the songs in their own way. The flash in the pan story is what people are just asking the question for, and it won't really make a difference in the long run.
We were talking about the great songwriters. I mean, there's a whole parlor game of trying to guess which Bob Dylan song is about
or which Stevie Nicks song is about Lindsay and about Mick, or you know, like it's just kind of like.
That's so another time-honored tradition.
Exactly. Pop culture. That's what it is. And now we're in that period now where people are just going to ask. And like, it's not like I'm writing songs to stab someone in the back or anything. It's just kind of like, it doesn't really matter who they're about. You know, I'm not like going after. If I was going after someone, then yeah, people want to know who it is, but it's fine. I don't mind. It's all good.
Right, but it's not a rap battle. We're not talking about... You're not coming after Eminem on this record.
No. 50's not getting it. 50 Cent is not coming after him.
The Nice to Meet You tour
mm-hmm.
with Louis Capaldi starts in April.
Yep.
You'll be playing arenas, which is... both a return and something new.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
How does it feel and how are you preparing?
Well, we're in rehearsals right now. I'm very excited about it. Playing an hour and a half show with one album last time was tough. Trying to stretch things out, add in covers and bits and pieces, which was great. Only get to do it once. But the idea of playing two albums now in arenas, going back to arenas like it was with the lads... putting on an arena show, designing that stage, designing the screen content, situating the band, the lighting, just that feeling of being wrapped in an arena and still trying to make an intimate show. I love all of this. This is what it's about. This touring aspect of what we do is the best part of what we do.
What should fans expect? I mean, you talked about trying to make an intimate show in an arena. How do you go about doing that?
Well, set listing is a big one. You know, I'm lucky that I've got intimate songs, and I've also got some mad ones, which as a blend will make for a nice show, because you can have roller coaster moments, you know, start with a bang and then dip down for a little bit and come back up and dip down again, and you know, you have to bring people on a journey across the hour and a half or the whatever it is. I'm looking at probably an hour and 35 or something like that, I think we're at, which is great. You know, we're playing more songs than an arena show would usually have. Planning on playing 22 or 3. And having to like bringing the lighting down at certain points, or you know, I've got a B stage, so I'll be doing some ballads out on the B stage and making the arena feel smaller than it is, because those arenas are huge.
Should we expect any collaborative moments between you and Lewis? Or
Lewis is on his own tour at the moment, so I need to get in with him. But yeah, the idea would be for me and Lewis to do something at some point. I mean, we can't sell the tour as myself and Lewis and then do nothing about it. But yeah, I mean, it's natural. Whatever happens, you know, we'll do a cover. We could do something we've written together. I don't know. You know, whatever that is, we'll have to have a moment, yeah.
Lewis, this is well known that you came across his music early on.
Yeah.
You got in touch with him. You invited him to open a show of yours in Glasgow.
That's right.
So that makes me ask, what are you listening to these days? Who's your next discovery?
Well, okay. There's so much stuff going on at the moment. I've been listening to a lot of singer-songwriter-ish vibes at the moment. There's a girl I'm bringing on my tour in the UK and Europe, an English girl called Maisie Peters, who, if you haven't heard of her in the States, you should wrap your ears around that, because her voice is beautiful. She's real talent. She's coming on tour with me in the UK and Ireland. She'd be kind of my next... I'm not saying I discovered her, but she would be like, if I was to spread that to the world, I think Maisie Peters is my next thing. But Lewis, yeah, just like, if my cousin has this knack of finding artists who have gone on to do unbelievable things when they've had like minimal views or listens. Or I remember he played me that Tones and I song, the one that went on to take over the world, about 2 years ago, because it was like he was living in Australia at the time. He was like, this is going to be a smash worldwide, and he was right. Or he found, I remember he played me James Bay when James Bay first entered. I think he's seen him in a pub somewhere. Or
wait, and what does your cousin do? What's
works in sports. He's a sports agent. He just has this
amazingly not an A&R person.
And I've been trying to tell people, but he has this knack. He's again with Lewis. He showed me Lewis when Lewis had like 200 views on like this Vivo video of him singing a cappella in an old house, and it was like the first thing that they'd done for Lewis. And he played me this video. I was like, whoa. So I just wrote to Lewis. I was like, dude, I love this song. I love these songs. I love your voice. Because his voice is like quite captivating. You very rarely hear that much gravel with that much range. And just wrote to him and said, yeah, do you want to come and play if we're about? And we went and met up for a few beers in Glasgow when we were there over a rugby game. And then he came up the next day and played a few tunes. And basically, I am the reason why he's so successful. no, but if you have that much talent, that much wit, and can write songs like that, I'm just happy that songs are back.
Yeah, no, Lewis's success is quite amazing. And you mentioned songs are back, but not every great songwriter, you hear so many of them, not every great songwriter goes on to that kind of monster success.
No, and it's just a lot of the big tunes are just fluke. He said he was just sitting at home and playing the minimal piano that he can play. Like most songwriters, like, I can't play much piano, but I can play enough to write a tune on it. And Lewis said, that's why the piano part on Someone You Loved is so simple. It's just going... And he said he just sat there and just started singing. And you just have to cross your fingers every time you open your mouth to do a melody that it's a good one. And he bumped into it and had a concept, and now it's the biggest song on the planet.
And sometimes those limitations are really useful. Like when you don't know how to do it, you discover either something new about your own approach to it or an approach to it in general.
Oh, 100%. It proves it. You can have days where you're just absolutely useless and nothing comes out. And then you have days of absolute magic. I find that like a lot of my better songs have come from like early in the process. I wrote Put a Little Love of Me and No Judgment in the first week, and last album I wrote This Town and Too Much to Ask 2 days in a row. You know what I mean? It's just because your ideas are fresh. You knew what you were going to write about before you walked in the room. You had a piano part for that. You had a riff. You're well prepared. The longer it goes on and the ideas start to dwindle out, you know, the harder it becomes and you get writer's block more often.
Till the time we both find ourselves alone again.
Like, I remember running into a corner and just calling my manager and be like, listen, cancel all the sessions we've got for the next 2-3 weeks, because I'm just running into a corner here and I feel like I'm just writing crap and I just need more time to just, you know, reconfigure everything, get my concepts back in line, you know, think about other angles for this Heartbreak Weather thing, and then reconvene. And that's what happened, because the reconvene part came when I got to the Bahamas.
So what did you do for those 2 weeks? When you'd run yourself into the corner, how did you get out?
Played a lot of golf on my own. I find playing golf on my own is a great one, because you get to listen to, like, I'll put a speaker in the golf cart, listen to stuff that I'm into, and then, like, I'll hear a line in a song and it'll spark an idea, and then I'll write that down, and then, you know, before you know it, I've got, like, I'll show you here. This is in the last... I haven't pulled up my notes on my phone. What one is this from? This one started on the 28th of February. And these are just stuff I just wrote right down.
So you're jotting all this down in the golf cart while you're...
Yeah, like, just kind of like... This is like... And this is right up until the present day, like... Howl at the Moon, House of Pain. A song about, like, I wrote down the word strange and the idea of, like, when you break up with someone and now they're just a stranger to you, when they were a stranger beforehand as well. You know, I just kind of write random stuff down, random little stories that happened to me. Just write. I'm just, look, I mean, that's...
Yeah, that's quite a, there's quite a few things there.
Yeah, but that stuff's happening all the time. I might see something on the street or see a couple and like the look of it or, you know, like just random little bits and just write something down. It sounds quite creepy, but... It helps, you know.
When you were playing golf, where were you golfing?
Well, I got, well, in LA, I kind of play in the public golf courses and then here...
No, come on.
Yeah.
You go out on the public golf course in LA.
It's hard to play golf in LA. You have to be like, you have to be well connected. You have to know a member of some place or something.
You don't know people who can get you on a good golf course in LA.
In LA, the hardest thing to do is, come on, boys, let's go and play golf. Because you have to go and play with the CEO of this or that. Okay. And, you know, it's a private club or... So I just go to the public spots and nice and cheap and cheerful, and I just love getting out. I don't care where I play. And then here in London, I'm a member of a place called Wentworth, which is beautiful. And kind of just literally get in the golf cart on a sunny day, go around on my own, listen to a few tunes, make a few notes. And
does it have to be a sunny day, or are you one of those crazy rain or shine golfers?
I grew up in Ireland where it rains for about 360 days of the year. So I am now a fair weather golfer. I live in Los Angeles. It's 25 degrees every day, or 75 every day.
Thank you for the conversion from Celsius to Fahrenheit.
It's probably about 24, but and 74. Yeah, become a bit of a fair weather golfer these days. So yeah, when it's sunny, I do a lot more of my golfing on tour because I'm, you know, don't have much to do until about 4 in the afternoon.
Well, it's a healthy occupation, I suppose, compared to some of the other things where you could get up to on tour.
Exactly. No, I've been trying to do less boozing, if you like, because trying to sing for an hour and a half every night at the level that I have to be at for people to spend $100 for a ticket or whatever it is. You can't give value for money if you're drinking every night. So I'm not going to be doing that. And I'm going to be playing more golf.
So you were saying that on the Flickr tour, you were breaking out some covers. You did quite a few classic rock covers. You did Springsteen, Tom Petty, the Eagles. Sometimes there were nods to Hometown Heroes. You were in Dublin. You did Thin Lizzy.
That's right.
Did U2.
Yep.
Did a Billy Joel song when you played Long Island.
That's right, yep.
So the tour's opening in Nashville. Are you getting a Garth Brooks song ready?
No, but I was talking to Maren Morris. I have a song with Maren Morris from my last album, Seeing Blind. And the whole idea that, like, if she hasn't had her baby or if she's already had the baby and wants to, it's an open door for her to come into the arena and sing Seeing Blind with me if that is baby permitting. But that would be fun if we could do, because it's the first night of the tour. It's actually a shame that it's in Nashville, because you want to announce, the fans are waiting online to see what the set list is. But if it's like, if I'm in Nashville and I want to bring loads of my country friends up on stage, I kind of broken that.
Because you spent a fair amount of time in Nashville on the last record.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I love Nashville. Honestly, I thought about like getting a place there for a while, because it's such a, like, it's exactly the way I like to live my life. It's so chilled out. People just write songs. It's like for fun. The people are just great down there. I'm just really getting into country music. I've got a lot of friends in country music.
And there's just no place I've been in the world where music is taken more seriously, but not in an overly serious way. Like it's so much a part of the culture.
Yeah, it's just it's a passion thing. It's a cultural thing. It's called Music City. You know what I mean? Like, it's just their life. Like, you go into a bar, a random pub in Nashville, you'd probably hear one of the best guitarist players you've ever heard. Like, it's just...
You go for a sandwich, right? I mean, literally anywhere. You're in the airport, there's a guy playing guitar. Yeah.
And he's unbelievable. He's not just like, you know, Joe Schmuck. He's like, he's really good. I just love it there. In a way, I'm happy I'm opening the tour there, but it's also a city that makes me nervous. Like, it's like playing
the
your
bar
home,
is high.
It's like playing your hometown show. Or when I play in London, I get nervous. When I play in LA, I get nervous. When I play in Dublin, I get nervous. When I play in Nashville, I get nervous. Because you know that there's very talented musicians in the crowd, even if you know it or not.
So since we're talking just a little bit about covers, I want to ask you one thing. Mm. I heard you say recently that when you were a kid, you're 13 years old, you're playing in pubs. And so you needed to know songs for an older crowd. Mm. So you'd be playing Dylan, McCartney. What was your Dylan song?
God almighty, I can't even fucking remember. I play lots of McCartney, play a lot of Beatles. Love playing Yesterday because people could sing along to it. Hey Jude was always a good one for a pub. When I first started like making my own musical decisions, because I was brought up on like the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac, and then at a certain point I was like, oh, actually I can go looking for music myself. It was Thin Lizzy was a big one for me, because like I was getting into my first bands in school and standing in my friend's garage playing tunes, and I remember hearing the song Dancing in the Moonlight with Thin Lizzy, and I remember thinking that is got a bit of everything. You know, I love Bruce Springsteen, so it's got the brass section. I love that the bass player is the lead singer. I love the tone of his voice and how energetic some of the songs are, like Whiskey in the Jar and The Boys Are Back in Town, and like that summed up Ireland. And, you know, I think another one was like the idea of a black musician being a black, powerful Irish musician was huge for me as well. I remember always kind of relating black culture and music to America and stuff like that. But having an Irish, black frontman was unbelievable for me. And discovering music at that level was amazing. So having the Thin Lizzy and McCartney and people like that, it was great. I'm just so lucky that I was brought up in that type of music.
And when you were growing up and starting to play at that time, was it music of the past that you were latching onto, or was there contemporary stuff that you were listening to as well?
Yeah, there was all the old stuff, all the stuff that we've mentioned. And then there was like, my mother was a big fan of Shania Twain and Garth Brooks, so I had that kind of country thing already, the Irish music thing and the country music thing.
So you can do Friends in Low Places in Nashville.
Yeah,
you can do it.
Friends. I loved Garth Brooks when I was a kid. He was like, when I was a kid, he was playing like stadiums in Ireland. He was huge. And then I was like, what else was I listening to at the time? Kind of went like when I got into my teenage years, then I had like a more of a emo kind of punk rock, kind of Green Day, Fall Out Boy, My Chemical Romance.
No Dashboard Confessional?
No, none of that. No. just kind of what was in the charts at the time when punk had its kind of big moment there. Hopefully that comes back around. It'll be brilliant. That kind of stuff. Was going to a lot of gigs. Then I was like into the English rock scene, which is like the Kooks, the Fratellis, the Razorlight, Arctic Monkeys, that very like north of England punk, like Oasis. Remember going to watch a gig at Slane Castle in Ireland, and it was Kasabian opening up for the Prodigy, opening up for Oasis, and it was like the best night of my life, I think. A lot of underage drinking happened that night. Drink responsibly. You know what I mean? And that's the kind of stuff that was massive in my teens. So when people say, when I've played Nice to Meet You now, and people are like, oh, it sounds very like the Arctic Monkeys. Yes, because I was a teenager once when they were big. And that's the kind of stuff that I listen to and I naturally kind of play when I pick up a guitar and write a riff. I was always very guitar driven. Like I love pop music, and I remember like I auditioned for the X Factor with like a Neo song or something, and I loved the R&B era of like Chris Brown, Neo, Jordan Sparks, Kerry Hilson, Kanye when he was in his prime. I loved all that stuff, but I always kind of kept going back to either like singer songwriter vibes, like because I was brought up on like Damien Rice as well. He was huge when I was a kid, and that album changed my life. But I always found myself going back to like the rocky guitar driven stuff, and when you hear my music now, it all starts to make sense, I think.
It does indeed. And Niall, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for flying all the way from America.
Oh, that was the easy part, to be honest. It's walking around in London that was terrifying to me.
Yeah, why?
Well, because, you know, I'm from New York, so the cars are coming from the wrong place.
And New York is a scary enough city as it is. You don't need the cars coming from the opposite direction. But no, I appreciate you coming over and doing this, because it's a big trek to make for an interview, so I appreciate it.
No, complete pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Inside the Studio is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.